What would does do they then?
This is the fourth Naman Talks for April 2007. The Naman Talks are a series of interviews with personalities in the domain of human-computer interaction, with ideas that deserve a closer look. My name is Johannes van der Meulen of Naman, and today we're having Michelle Bowens, who leads the Foundation for P2P Alternatives. Michelle, thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
I've known Michelle as one of the early local Belgian internet pioneers and as a creator of two internet.com companies, as well as editor-in-chief of a Flemish digital lifestyle magazine that was called Wave, similar to Wires at the time, wasn't it? And among his original job titles were Cybrarian at BP, that's Beyond Petroleum, right? And the European Manager of Thought Leadership at March 1st. Later he was e-business strategy manager at Belgacom. Belgacom is the dominant Belgian telecoms operator. And in October 2002, he left that job for Chiang Mai, which is a second largest city in Thailand, in the mountains in the north. He created the Foundation for Peer-to-Peer Alternatives, a virtual organization which conducts research on the peer-to-peer relational dynamic. Michelle, you define peer-to-peer, P2P, as more than just the sharing of files and films and music by teenagers. You call it the relational dynamic of distributed networks. So can you explain that?
Yeah, so I think the important thing is to distinguish two kinds of networks which look alike when you look at them, if you make a picture of them, but are quite different in their underlying dynamic. And what I mean is the following. Through an example, if you take a plane from New Orleans to Minneapolis, you have to go through Atlanta. Atlanta is a chosen hub. And so as an agent, as a person, you are not free in your actions and relationships. These have been determined for you. But if you take a car for the same road, Atlanta is still a big hub because many people, you know, might actually take the car and go through that hub. But you don't have to go through that hub. In other words, as an agent, as a person, you are free in your relationships and your actions. And so what I'm saying is that more and more the underlying infrastructure, technological infrastructure of our society is designed as a peer-to-peer network. And this is not just a relationship amongst computers, it's more importantly a relationship amongst people. So more and more we have these people aggregating, congregating, and producing stuff together and managing that stuff together and protecting the stuff they do together. And this is what I, you know, what I actually mean with peer-to-peer.
What's the relational dynamic then in those distributed networks? What's particular about the dynamics?
Well, the particular thing is that you don't have a prior hierarchy or a fixed hierarchy. You usually have somebody saying, you know, like Richard Stallman saying, okay, I want to make free software. Or Linus Torvalds saying, I want to make an alternative operating system, Linux. Or Jimmy Wales saying, I want to make a universal encyclopedia where everybody can participate. Or in my own case, I want to study peer-to-peer. Who wants to join me? So in this case, you have someone inviting other people to do something together, and you don't have, you know, like in a, let's say, a traditional for-profit environment, you don't have any power over that person because you're inviting them to work together and there's no wage relationship. You're not making something for the market, so there's also no price relationship for that product. And that's a whole new dynamic. Of course, you do have hierarchy, you do have leadership, but it's quite different from both, let's say, centralized bureaucratic leaderships, which you can also find in corporations, in big corporations. It's also different from allocating resources to the market.
Right. It's more based on voluntary effort. It's altruistic to a certain degree. If you talk about altruism quickly, you think about idealism, naive idealism, utopian ideas?
I don't think it's the right way to frame it, because of course when you say like that, of course people will, you know, will be very skeptical about counting on the altruism of people. So I think people are a mixed bag of motivations. Part of the motivation might be altruistic. I don't think you can ignore that. But the thing is that the threshold, the price for doing things together has gone down. In other words, more and more you want to do things together. You don't have to go through a heavy capital investment. You don't have to go through institutional framework to do things together. And it's really more a question of design. How can you design projects so that the individual interest coincides with the collective interest? So, for example, when you're working on Wikipedia, the collective interest for the encyclopedia coincides with the individual interest of the person wanting to write about a particular subject.
Right. Do you see, we know wikis, we know such peer-to-peer infrastructures. Do you see on your horizon new infrastructures coming up that can support that sort of low threshold collaboration?
I think so. So that's actually what I'm trying to describe through the Peer-to-Peer Foundation is three processes. One is peer production, doing things together. The second thing is peer governance. How do you manage those projects? And this is about new kinds of institutionalizations. It's not that there is no institutions, it's they're different. And how are they different? That's what I want to find out. And finally, there's something called peer property, which is about protecting the common work against private appropriation. Those are the things I'm interested in.
Those three: production, governance,
and property, which is about distribution. How do you distribute the common work?
These are alternative copyright schemes,
exactly,
such as Creative Commons.
Yes, I make a difference between the truly commons-oriented licenses, like the general public license, or the license used by Wikipedia, where you know you're working on something together. Your authorship is recognized, but the result of your authorship is a common good. I distinguish that from the Creative Commons type of licenses where you're mainly expressing yourself, alone or in group, and your priority is to have your expression and to share your expression. And so in this case, you have the Creative Commons license, which retains the sovereignty of the individual over his authorship, but gives him a whole series of options, how far you want to share what you've produced. And the most used is probably the one that says, everybody can reproduce and distribute my work, but you can't make money from it. That's probably the most chosen one.
Hmm. You've mentioned Wikipedia a lot. It's in the public mind, clearly. Right now, there are issues with Wikipedia. What's your take on issues of authority? Collaboration at Wikipedia right now. Wikipedia is going through a little bit of a crisis. Is that correct?
I think so. So it's pretty much the same as, you know, with other forms of governance. It's, you know, it's not just a solution. It also creates its own problems. So and the main problem with peer governance is you encounter problems. You have to first of all find a mechanism for production, find a mechanism for filtering the production, find a mechanism for protecting it from people who might have bad intentions with your production. Mm. And, you know, as you do that, without prior hierarchy, you are still going to produce norms, community norms, regulations. So you end up, and that's what Wikipedia is doing, you know, with an accumulation of little rules, which makes sense, you know, once you encounter the problems. But for somebody new, he comes into the existing project and is, you know, faced with an existing culture, mm-hmm. which he might not be able to navigate in a very easy way. So it takes a whole engagement of the person to actually, you know, get to know those rules and use them. The way I distinguish peer governance from democratic governance is the following. If you have peer governance, you are operating in a field of abundance, digital, immaterial knowledge that can be easily reproduced, easily distributed. So it doesn't matter, you know, you don't have to make decisions of who does what. You let people decide what they want to do, and you have a posteriori, after the fact, filtering mechanism to decide, you know, what's the best solution.
Which is possible with the infrastructure
exactly.
that is in place. Yes.
While in democratic governance, you are working with scarce resources, So you have to decide collectively, you know, who is going to get what resources. And that's the difference between, I think, classic democracy and peer governance. Now, peer governance usually starts with no rules and gradually, you know, acquires rules. And those rules are necessary because it's not because you have no rules that you have no power. Just to give you an example, you can have anarchist groups and, you know, there's no power, but actually there's going to be a dominant figure somewhere pulling the strings maybe, right? So it's sometimes better to have actually open rules that people can discuss and can change rather than say we have no rules, where actually the rules are hidden from view. So peer governance is not a system without rules. It's a system with structure, but it's more flexible ad hoc than classic bureaucratic or, you know, democratic rules.
Right, and it's easy to maintain small communities with a set of rules, and they are more fluid, easy to change.
Exactly. And so the great change, I think, is the following. We have now a technology that allows global coordination of micro projects. In other words, if you look at the way the Wikipedia is produced, or the way Linux is produced, or the way most of these projects are produced, it's not 50,000 people working together. It's small teams, 1 to 4. But globally, there's a coordination. There's a way that all these things fit together. And that used to be very expensive to do. And now with digital technology, it's very cheap to do. And this is a new thing. So we can actually apply the rules for small groups on massive, scalable projects. And that was not possible before.
Yes. The cost of coordination has
exactly
reduced.
Yeah.
Peer-to-peer can happen because people have time available. They often contribute to peer-to-peer networks on an altruistic basis. That is, there is no financial gain. These people still have to make a living. There is an employer who pays their monthly wages. In view of this, do you think that peer-to-peer can become a dominant mode of operation in the immaterial world of where intellectual goods are being exchanged?
Yes, I think so. So let me first say the following. If you look at the sustainability of peer-to-peer projects, you have to distinguish the individual point of view and the collective point of view. Collectively, as long as for X percent of people leaving, you can recruit X percent replacement or more, you have a sustainable collective project. So most of those projects are sustainable on a collective basis because there's a throughput of people. You know, somebody has no more time, he will be replaced by somebody else who at that time has the time. And individually, those people will regulate their lives so that they can actually spend time doing peer projects. Certainly amongst programmers, what you see is a new kind of mentality where the paid job is an excuse and a means to do the chosen job, which is not paid. That happens more and more. Now, so we have a collective sustainability, but we have a problem on the individual level. And this is a problem for society, because what I'm saying the following. The market, okay, peer-to-peer, as you say, it's a phenomenon of abundance, surplus, is dependent on the existing infrastructures, wages, you know, social structures, whatever. But more and more, the market is dependent on social innovation. In other words, what I'm saying is that more and more innovation is no longer confined within the corporation. You cannot say, as you used to say, you know, the view of Schumpeter, you have a company, is going to fund some innovation, it's going to protect it through copyright, and then you have a rent, you know, rent because you protect the intellectual copyright. More and more, it's diffuse innovation. It's the customers changing stuff, adding stuff, proposing stuff. You can see it in extreme sports, in surfing, kite surfing, windsurfing, water surfing. It's a built-only capitalism where actually it's the users innovating and the workshops or factories just producing what the users have, you know, proposed. So this, I think this model is going to be, it's a growing model. The same
the
if you look at...
model from Eric von Hippel and democratizing innovation.
Yes, it's described in detail in the Democratization of Innovation of Eric von Hippel. But now if you look at music, now as a musician you have a double choice. You can say, okay, I will have copyright And what you then have to do, because it's actually now possible to copy for free, okay, you have to choose either the law or technology to actually repress the freedom of users to share what you've produced, because they can do it and they will do it. And knowing that actually, I think less than 1% of the people actually live from copyright nowadays. Or you can say, okay, I'll have my creative output in Creative Commons. And I can still live from my performances, from derivative services, from the sale of CDs of people who want a box with, you know, some added value. So it's becoming a choice. And more what I'm saying is that at least in the immaterial production, you have asymmetric competition between a for-profit company, which has to pay everybody, which has to protect its copyright, faced with new kinds of institutions like the Mozilla Foundation, like the Apache Foundation, like the, I'm not sure about the name of the Linux Foundation, but something of that order, I think, exists, where those people rely on a large community of volunteers with only one goal, make the best possible product. And it's in a free license, so everybody can copy and use it. So my question is, who's going to win? Yeah, I think in many cases, this asymmetric competition will be won by those new, you know, peer projects.
Well, what about recuperation by the corporation of these peer-to-peer initiatives? Is there a way for the peer-to-peer initiatives to inoculate themselves against being recuperated?
Well, as long as you protect, let's say, the commons, the common knowledge base, then most of these projects do not mind that companies actually live from them, because actually the same people who do the commons also need to make a living. So what you see around open source is a wide variety of business strategies that say, okay, we respect the commons, we'll support the commons, but we'll take some derivative strategy. For example, Red Hat, which would say, okay, I'll have a nice CD, it's more easy to install, it's more secure, it's guaranteed, there is service associated with it. And that you go to the market, but that does not destroy the commons. And the companies like IBM and Red Hat are going to find ways to support the commons, because through supporting the commons, they support their own development.
Taking a different, maybe more philosophical approach again, there is a concept of the tragedy of the commons. Can you explain that?
Okay, so the tragedy of the commons is basically a situation where the individual only sees his own interest and is going to use a collective resource without regard for the collective. So this is a big problem in physically limited resources. Everybody using water, or everybody using the common ground for his own sheep to graze. Okay, It's quite different in the digital material context, because there's no scarce resource.
There's abundance.
There's an abundance, and actually there's a network effect. The more people use it, the more information you get on the collective project, the more usage, the more value the commons has. So the tragedy of the commons does not have the same application in material environment. You know, you have to look at what is scarce in that field of abundance, and that field of scarcity is subject to a tragedy of the commons, and that, you know, that can be different in different projects. For example, everybody can produce information, but then you have the filtering mechanism. Now, if you can, and of course, what comes on top will be read more than what comes on the bottom. So you might have a tragedy of the commons, but with people trying to manipulate scarce attention.
Right.
That's an issue of peer governance. It's an issue of design. How do you avoid that?
So, but people's time is going to be the scarce resource forever, right? Because there's only 24 hours in a person's day. However, you know, whatever you do to your body or to the environment, it's going to be 24 minus anything between 3 and 8 hours for sleep. P2P going to change the world, and is it going to be for the better, Michel?
I should say with a qualified yes, in the sense that, okay, let's take peer production. So what my claim would be that when people select their own jobs voluntarily and work on it passionately, they're going to produce high-quality goods, high-quality immaterial goods.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what you can see if you look at Linux or Wikipedia. Despite its problems, as a process, you can see it's working. It has faults, but it has a lot of qualities.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, competitively, you know, holding itself against the for-profit competition.
I haven't used the Encyclopedia Britannica for quite a while.
Exactly. Okay, so it must have some value. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, so I think this is a good thing about it. The same thing with peer governance. When you can co-decide and participate in small groups, it's going to be more democratic than either a corporate, you know, system of this decision or a democratic form of decision. Because in a democratic form of decision, you have majority against minority, you have scarce resources, and they will say, well, sorry, guys, you can't do that, right? Mm. That's the problem you avoid in peer governance. And then in the forms of distribution and peer property, private property says it's mine, it's not yours, you can't use it. Collective property from the state says it's ours, but I decide, you know, some group decides what we're going to do with it. But with a Creative Commons license, or more precisely a general public license, you are saying everybody can use it. So it's actually more distributive. So if you take into account those three arguments, I would say we have a very important social innovation. But of course, that's not to say it's going to create its own problems. It has its weaknesses.
Sure.
We're not trying to be utopian. We're trying to be concretely utopian. And what I'm trying to say is the following. Let's see what works. Let's learn from each other. And let's disseminate the things that work, rather than say, okay, this is how things should be and people should be that way, which is, you know, the old utopian thinking. So here you're more thinking about networked connections and reinforcing each other and learning from each other. And so in that sense, yes, I think that, you know, it's not about peer-to-peer having better solutions in the abstract. It's about a better way to deal with complexity. So we're facing all these problems in the world, and we can see that authoritarianism is not a good solution. We are seeing that democracy is actually losing some legitimacy, even in the West. It's not working right. We, you know, everybody
trust
has the same feeling, right? So if we can find more participative, more peer-to-peer oriented governance solutions, we can find new solutions. So nobody has the solutions, but the process is better to obtain the solutions. That's my claim.
There's an impressive body of knowledge on the site of the foundation. Can you say something about what's on there? Maybe point people to the place where they can find it, etc.
Okay. So most of our resources are available through p2pfoundation.net, and so it's different things. There is a weekly newsletter. There's a blog, where a group of people, about a dozen people, publish regularly or irregularly, you know, their thoughts about P2P-oriented news. And finally, there's a wiki for consolidated knowledge. And that wiki has already, I think, about 3,000 pages of information. So we cover everything that's what we call open and free. In other words, if you want to work together, you need open and free raw material. So you have free software, open access, open content, all these movements in the world, open data, that strive to open up the cultural production for sharing. Then you have participation, everything which is participative in terms of governance. So we look at all the new ways that people are trying to find solutions to the problems they encounter when they work together. And finally, we follow what we call the commons, which is the output side. And if you see how it works, you can see it's input, open and free, participation as a process, commons as an output, and that creates in turn new open and free material. And so we follow those three paradigms as they express themselves in every field of human endeavor. You'll find things that you won't expect, like open yoga, open Reiki, for example.
Open what?
Open Reiki, you know, some kind of spiritual healing.
Okay.
It's always the same problem. Like in yoga, there's some American yoga master which has copyrighted yoga moves, which is absurd, because it's a, you know, it's a human collective development of thousands of years, right? So as a reaction against that private appropriation, people are saying, well, then we need open yoga. We need actually to protect yoga, you know, from this privatization.
Recuperation, yes.
Yeah.
And how many people are involved? Well, can you say something about the social dynamic within your foundation? I mean, you are overseeing, if I may say so, the effort. How many people are involved? How do you work with them?
Right. Well, it's a, you know, it's a relatively small effort in the sense that in I started working on it, I guess, in 2004. I wrote a manuscript, you know, call to arms in a way. Mm. Then in 2000, no, actually, I'm wrong. I wrote it in 2005. I put things online in 2006. And that's when I started, you know, attracting people.
That's early 2006,
yeah.
I assume, yes.
So the wiki, the blog, you know, they're about 1 year old now, more than 1 year old. Mm. And so the reality is we probably have about 2,000 people who work regularly or irregularly on the resources. Probably 6 people are really kind of like...
Hardcore.
You know, hardcore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you need those.
And of course, I'm one of those. Mm-hmm. Of course, the other side is the users. And we're not doing that bad because in our wiki, we have 1 million page views.
Per?
In a year. Mm-hmm. And it's about, you know, 116,000 people went to our homepage. And some statistics I saw is that about, you know, the average individual sees about 10 pages. So it's actually really used. Yeah. It's really used as a resource. Yes. It's not just coming in and out. The blog is, you know, more smaller. It's about 300 people a day now. But it's a B list. It's you know, there's the, you have those lists, Technorati, you know, they calculate.
So you're a B.
We are a B. We're not an A list, but we are a B list, which is not bad after a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we have a legal foundation in Holland. It's not just virtual. It's actually also has a legal arm, you know, which is needed, you know, in case we, you know, might do some research and get some money from somewhere or whatever. Yeah, so that's the idea.
And Michel, you're doing all this from Thailand. No, this is a personal note. You know, what took you to Thailand from Belgium?
Well, as you said in the introduction, I'm a former entrepreneur. So I had, you know, 2 companies and one of them did fairly well. And so I had some reserves. And when I decided to quit the corporate world, which, in 2002, I said, well, if I go to a country where it's good living and cheaper, you know, my reserves will last, you know, that but longer.
By a factor of four.
And so that gave me the liberty to study for 2 years without, you know, earning an income. And then slowly I've been, you know, I'm going back to the market in a way. And so I'm pretty much like the artist in a Creative Commons context. You know, I produce everything in the Commons, the wiki, the blog, the newsletter. But I gain knowledge, I gain relationships, I gain reputation, and those things are marketable. So in other words, I actually now live for my, you know, conferences on the topic. And I think that's a pretty exemplary example of how things can evolve and how actually things are working for many of those peer projects.
Okay. I think I'd like to now finish the interview, Michel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.